It's Wednesday, June 9th, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, what exactly do naming rights get you? We're still waiting to find out whether the University of North Carolina will reconsider its offer to Pulitzer Prize winner Nicole Hannah Jones, but it seems one of those who fought to deny her tenure in the original offer was a big name donor. How big? His name is on that journalism school. Also, first gas, then meat processors, then the media. Cox Media Group was among those to fall to a ransomware attack. And when one of the world's top tennis players would rather pay a five-figure fine than talk to reporters, where's the problem? Is it her or is it with us as journalists? I'm going to ask Ernest and Kathy about that. And there's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today. But first, one of the biggest investigations we've seen from ProPublica in the recent past, the first in what it says will be a series of reports on the private tax data of the 1,000th of 1%, the Jeff Bezoses, Michael Bloomberg's, Warren Buffett's, and Elon Musk's of the world. There were 25 people in that mix. Kathy, what'd they find?
Well, they don't pay taxes, which is not necessarily a shock. I think we've long kind of known, and it's been talked about a lot, that the most wealthy Americans pay the least proportionally in the amount of taxes they pay. But ProPublica has the goods. I mean, they got leaked tax documents, which are very hard to get. There's a very interesting editor's note that I know you included on the Links blog about why they chose to publish this information. But what they're finding really is that most of us, of course, get taxed on our income, and so pay an average of 14% of our income goes to supporting the federal government and all the things it does. But for the very wealthiest, they don't really take income. And what was fascinating to me about the ProPublica story is they really dissected how a lot of these people are living, and they never cash in on their investments, so they never have to pay taxes, but they borrow against those investments.
So they're able to almost show losses sometimes.
Yes, and they're able to write off, in some cases, the interest rates are so low that it really actually pays them to borrow the money they're living on. I think it's a really fascinating expose of how the other half lives, or the other 1,000.
Well, I mean, if you really sit down and think about it, I mean, which is, you know, I read it and I sat down and I thought about it and I went like, basically what they're doing is they're writing off their lifestyles. Mm-hmm. And those of us who draw a salary, those of us who work for a living, let's put it that way, whether you're talking about white collar or blue collar or agricultural or however you want to describe it, labor does not get to write off its lifestyle. I mean, and we, the deductions that we used to get, we don't even have those anymore after the last tax overhaul under the Trump administration. Many of those are gone now. So, but they're continuing to be able to do this and increase the amount of their net worth by basically writing off the way in which they live, and whatever work they do doesn't really matter. It doesn't really count toward the taxable amount that the government is bringing in. So, you know, this whole infrastructure conversation that we're having as well doesn't factor into that.
Well, and that's one of the interesting points and one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Ernest. They talk about how they got this, why they decided to report on this. Why do it now? What is it about right now that makes it a good touch point?
I think now is a touch point because we're talking about inequality. I mean, it's one of the things that coming out of the pandemic has really started to get people focused in on the haves and the have-nots, and that there is a larger number of have-nots, and even in the complexity of inequality is starting to sort of unfold and how it's played off over generations.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to that point, one of the big issues in the presidential campaign was the growing inequities in the society and the unraveling of the middle class. And when you look at the ProPublica editor's note, really what they're talking about, in the editor's note, one of the justifications for running these tax records, which is a violation of privacy by some people's lights, is that the public interest outweighs the right to privacy mm-hmm. here. That this kind of information needs to inform the public debate we're having about how we structure our tax system and why the middle class is unraveling. When you enable a small group of people to grab such a big piece of the pie, it doesn't leave very much for everyone else. And it does raise the question, as you did, Ernest, that if the ultra wealthy aren't paying their fair share, how do we pay for infrastructure improvements? Mm-hmm. So I think it really illuminates, or the idea behind the ProPublica story is that this will illuminate the public debate that we are trying to have about our tax structure.
Going to debate, this is the interesting part. Mm-hmm. So most of the debate yesterday in Congress was about how the records were obtained, more so than what the records say and what they show. You know, I'm sitting there, I'm going, like, wait a minute, you guys are arguing over the whether or not the IRS, who should be held liable for the records being obtained by ProPublica instead of what the records show, which is that you have a majority of the wealth, mm-hmm. not only in this country, but in this world, is controlled by these people, and they aren't paying taxes?
Well, and one of the other interesting things that you brought up is that some would argue that this is an invasion of privacy. And I would even ask, is it? Some of these names we're talking about, they're public figures. One of the other points in the editor's note is that in certain states here in our country, that income tax filings are public record in the sense that if I were to go, say, in Wisconsin and file a Sunshine Law or Freedom of Information Act request, I could get, Ernest, if you lived in Wisconsin, I could get yours. I could get yours, Kathy, no problem. And that there are other countries, specifically in the Scandinavian region, where all residents, all citizens' tax filings are 100% public information. And it raises that question of, is there an invasion of privacy?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're a little puritanical in mm-hmm. this country about talking about money.
Yes.
And I think any of us who have been in the journalism business would agree, transparency is a good thing. Sunlight is the best of disinfectants, and one of the reasons we have such a lack of trust in our public institutions is there is no transparency about the tax code. It's over the years, it's just it's like a ship covered with barnacles.
Exactly, the tax code has been written to shield the type of information that we see in these stories. I mean, the laws have been written to basically, number one, allow them to be able to do the things with their money that they're doing, shelter, write off, that sort of thing. And on top of that, to also shield the ability of anyone else to see what they're doing behind the curtain.
Exactly. And that is a recipe for corruption, and it's a recipe for distrust in the institution.
And inequality.
So I think ProPublica did a public service, and I think the whistleblower did a public service.
Okay. While we're kind of on that topic, I started thinking about this, and I'm about 7 years into hosting this program, Ernest, that you and I have been on this show. And in that time, how many times did we end up coming down on the Trump administration for not being on the up and up with reporters, for not holding news conferences, for the president not coming into the press briefing room and taking questions? Well, on Sunday, CNN aired a one-on-one interview with White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And while she was quick to point out that President Biden spoke to reporters on 77 of his first 100 days in office, Brian Stelter wanted to know, the host of that program, wanted to know why there had not been but one formal news conference.
The setting for a formal press conference that demands the country's attention, you all have chosen not to go that route. He doesn't give many interviews either. Is that part of an attempt to lower the temperature, be less visible, be boring?
Certainly not. I don't think anything we're doing around here is boring. Getting the pandemic under control, going on our first foreign trip, putting millions of Americans back to work. I don't know what version of that is boring. But I will tell you that there's an opportunity several times a week for the president to have an engagement and answer questions from reporters. I understand there's questions about a formal press conference, but that may be driven more by the media than it is by the American public, Brian.
I figured you'd say that.
So she spun that. She really did. But Ernest, you were nodding your head as you were saying that, that maybe there isn't as much of a need for that formal press conference.
Well, I think she's right. I mean, I think we want it, but...
We as in journalists, or we as in people who live out in the country?
We as in journalists.
Okay, very good.
I don't necessarily think that the public really cares one way or the other whether he has a press conference. What they want is... What is he doing? And how is he presenting it? And is he being transparent? And are we getting the information? And if that means he's getting it in one-on-ones, he's getting it in groups as he's walking out of a meeting or he's coming back into the White House from a trip, they're getting the information. So I think it's this sort of nostalgia for going back to the old days more so than anything else.
And as somebody who was in the White House press corps for a number of years, I'm not nostalgic for it at all. I think press conferences are really overrated, and they're more, they've become more a TV set piece now and a way to fill airtime, but I don't even think the journalists get that much out of it because because they're televised.
Yeah.
It's become a much more formal, rather than the kind of give and take that would be really useful. And what often happens is when there's a press conference, the poor White House reporters are so over-prepped by their bosses. Now, make sure you ask this, and the deputy managing editor wants you to ask that.
This is why I'm having the reaction I'm having, because I am that newscast producer sending the reporter out there saying, don't forget to ask about this. Don't forget to get something on that. Don't forget we did this story last week.
Right, and the poor person, when they get up there, and that's why there are no follow-ups. Because, oh my God, I have five editors asking me to do to ask these six questions.
Yeah. It's almost too scripted.
Yeah, it's way too scripted. It's way too scripted. So I'm good riddance. They're not that useful.
And you can still, as a reporter, and I want to ask this because I have that editor and producer hat on, you can still get the same quality ability to ask those questions, get the follow-ups that you would get in a walk and talk or in a gaggle as you might be able to get in that slightly more organized.
You get more.
I think
because
better,
you're able
I agree.
To have conversations and have a give and take as opposed to ask your question, get a response, move to the next person kind of format.
Yeah.
Okay. See, that's why we have reporters and editors and we have all of these different perspectives. It's worth talking about and mentioning that when we were here a month ago, and we started to talk about this a few minutes ago too, that we were talking about the revelation that the Trump administration had been seizing telephone records from reporters and that it had come out through the Department of Justice. And we were talking about, you were saying it yourself, that most of the conversation in Washington as we talk about the tax files has been about who leaked it. Well, we're hearing now from the Biden administration and the Department of Justice, they will not be seeking reporters' phone records anymore. That's going to be a change in policy.
And that's important. That is a very important decision. I mean, I think it's a good signal. It's not just a good signal to send reporters. It's a good signal to send the country. It's a confidence builder for sources. I mean, we just talked about the whistleblower in the case of the tax records. I think it's important for sources to know they're not going to be hunted down. And it's so much easier to hunt them down with the technology the way it is today.
Yeah.
Well, one of the biggest lies, or one of the biggest adds to the big lie this past week was Maggie Haberman's reporting for the New York Times that former President Trump believes that he will be reinstalled as president sometime in August. That is something that cannot happen constitutionally without a military coup. For people in the U.S. to be throwing those words around loosely like that is a little scary, especially when we're considering what's happening right now in Myanmar, where an actual military coup has all but wiped out the news media in that country. Kathy, journalists there are fleeing the country, literally running for their lives.
Yeah, this is it's a brutal situation, and I think this is why a lot of the loose rhetoric that came out during the Trump administration, and now we're seeing ex post facto, is particularly dangerous because of the impact it has in other countries that don't have democratic institutions as strong as ours. And what we were hearing over and over again, and I think Myanmar is an example of this, so is Belarus, it greenlights when U.S. officials talk the way the former president did about the press, it greenlights strongmen and dictators in other countries to do things that they otherwise might not have done. And I, for one, you know, I'm really hopeful that when President Biden meets with Vladimir Putin in a couple of days, he will raise the Belarus case. This is the infamous case where a commercial airliner was forced down by fighter jets just so the Belarus president could arrest a journalist, and who has clearly been tortured since then. But there's only one person who can really influence that crazy Belarusian guy, and that is Vladimir Putin. So I think President Biden has an opportunity to reassert U.S. leadership on free press issues, and doing that, I think, will provide some cover for journalists. The Myanmar situation's really bad. I don't see any quick fix for that other than for journalism organizations and countries around the world to try to help those reporters.
So, well, not nearly as severe a limit on speech or of the press. Last week, the Cox Media Group lost control of all of its television, radio station, and newspaper websites, falling victim to a ransomware attack, the latest target of cyber terrorists. Now, these hackers had been going after vital infrastructure. It seemed kind of strange to me, though, that it's taken this third attack, first on fuel, then on meatpacking, then on the media, for this to be seen as a national security threat and not just a criminal enterprise.
Well, I think it's been seen as a national security threat for a while.
Okay.
And there have been calls to deal with this issue going all the way back to the Obama administration. But there just hasn't been enough of a focus on it until they started hitting the kinds of infrastructure that we're talking about. And now, it's been a criminal enterprise for a while. They've been targeting this in small waves, and now they're hitting much larger operations and asking for more money. And now you're starting to see, as we saw yesterday, the FBI was able to get back some of the cryptocurrency that was paid out during the Colonial Pipeline. So now the government is starting to come back at it in certain ways, but people are starting to pay attention because it's starting to have an impact on everyday operations.
So we talk about that and bringing it back to the Cox Media Group issue a little bit. We were just kind of having some chit chat before the show today as we were setting up cameras and stuff about how different tools that we're using either in our production and our newsrooms here or as communication tools across the university with other colleagues, either here in the School of Journalism or across campus, how some of them have some, let's just say, irritating limitations. All of those rooted, like we're talking two-factor authentication or having to receive a telephone call to make sure that it's really us logging into the program. And Kathy, one of the first things that you said was it slows us down. Journalism is about speed. And Ernest, your thought was, yeah, but we have to be about security too.
Yeah, I mean, it's a two-way street. I mean, it doesn't impact you until it does. Mm-hmm. One of those sort of situations. So it's an irritant. Two-factor authentication, you brought up all of those. They're irritant at the time, but then when someone actually hacks in and takes over and you have no ability to do anything until you pay a ransom, then all of a sudden security becomes an issue. So, I mean, it's almost like you have to live with the good with the bad in those situations.
So one of the other things, too, is this is a story that happened to the Cox Media Group, but it's also one we have to continue to cover. One of the stories that's on our Lynx blog estimates that in the next decade that ransomware attacks could become a $265 billion liability in this country. How do we go about covering both the issue, how we guard against it. I know one of the articles I was reading this morning as I was just doing my morning reads was from the Wall Street Journal on telling people what not to put on social media, because that's how hackers are actually hacking your accounts, because you're putting, you know, your high school information or your college information. That's what we're using
to figure out your passwords, right? Exactly. Well, I think it's going to be full employment for tech reporters, and I think this is one of those topics that where the news media can be really helpful. Trusted sources, digging out that information, and it's a big story. It's kind of like the environment. You can do big 30,000-foot stories about the problem, the dollar amount that it could affect, but then you can bring it down to real people stories. What can I do to secure my accounts or my personal documents? So I think there's a lot to be done there. I think it's just like any technology; it can be used for good or bad. I don't know. Maybe we should dig out a few mimeograph machines in case we have to print the newspaper if we're taken over.
Yeah, my fear, the last point I'd make is my fear is that what we shouldn't do as journalists is cover this only as a crime, because then we miss out on a lot of the ideas that you came up with on how we should be. Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about Naomi Osaka. She's the world-class tennis player who withdrew from the French Open rather than continue to face $15,000 fines for refusing to grant media interviews. She talked to reporters after winning her first round match, but said she didn't want to do it again to protect her own mental health. Take a listen to The Atlantic's Kativa Davison.
She basically said, this was the boundary that she was trying to set for herself. That does make our jobs more difficult as journalists. But at the same time, I don't think that any athlete owes us their time. So the precedent that this can set will be actually very interesting to see. There's also a value judgment that every athlete, every subject, no matter what you're covering in journalism, has to make, which is it worth it for me to talk to this reporter? Do I think this reporter is coming at me in good faith? And if people like Naomi Osaka and other athletes are deciding that that's not the case, then that's something that we have to reckon with as an industry.
I was listening to a clip from Mike Greenberg, one of Mike Greenberg's shows last week on ESPN Radio. And in the interest of full disclosure, he is somebody who at one time I worked for him. But he said a lot of the same things on that program. Athletes don't need us anymore. They don't need us in the same way. They have no obligation to us. And in a lot of ways, it brings a new responsibility to sports journalists to think about how we approach them in the same way we would approach any other person. Say, after a loss, that's kind of a trauma in their workplace in some ways. And we've stopped treating athletes as anything beyond their sport.
Well, in many ways, we've never treated them any other way but the sport, the game, that particular moment. And now that these athletes have the ability to be able to create their own brands, and many of them have, they're basically saying, I'm going to control my narrative, and I'm going to be the one to make a determination as to who I'm going to talk to and who I'm not going to talk to. And that's what's happening right now. And you have these national and international sporting authorities, be it tennis, be it golf, be it whatever, who are basically saying, yeah, but we want to be able to control this too. And now you've got this back and forth going on right now. And I think the athletes are winning, and they should, because they're the ones in control of their mental health. They're the ones who are in control of their story and how they see themselves and how the public sees them. And so I think we as journalists are going to have to recognize that and start building relationships with these athletes that's more than just the game.
Well, beat reporters have for a long time had relationships with their sources, their athletic sources, just like any beat reporter would. And a good beat reporter does build a relationship with those sources. I think this is kind of a complicated situation. First of all, I go back to my comments earlier about press conferences. Mm-hmm. I think they're overrated. And those post-game press conferences are really particularly awful.
And you get nothing out of them.
But think about that for a second, because the purpose of those post-game press conferences in some ways is to limit, like, I think back to all of the days when I would go into a locker room, say a major league clubhouse, and you've got this big scrum of reporters and photographers literally crowding around an athlete who's in his underwear, right? Like, how many of our other sources would we walk up to unclothed and invade their privacy in that way to have that authentic conversation?
Yeah, no, I agree. And that was my second point.
Yeah.
The press conferences are actually created for the convenience of the athletes. I mean, these are celebrities, and any PR person, my dad was a PR person for a football team, you do that so that everybody gets their question, and then the athletes can go home.
Right.
So they don't. So it really is created for the convenience of the athletes, but it has become a set piece. And if Naomi Osaka's having depression, she's got a lot more problems than whether or not she's going to have a press conference. This, to me, mixing up media relations with somebody's mental health struggles is. It one shouldn't have anything to do with the other.
And I think the only reason that they started to was because it created that space for a conversation about a bigger kind of dialogue.
But I also think it was the Tennis Association basically saying, no, you have to do this, and if not, we're going to fine you, and we're going to fine you heavily, and we may even force you to withdraw from the tournament. That's when the public went, whoa, wait a minute, you have that kind of control over whether someone does a press conference. That became the story, and the her mental health issues also became a part of the story, and that is what was really driving this.
Okay, so before we go, I want to bring up a story many of us are watching closely and waiting to see what happens with. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones had given the University of North Carolina until last Friday to reevaluate its job offer for her to join the faculty of its Hussman Journalism School with tenure, or she would consider legal action against them. Tenure is a privilege afforded to most of the night chairs at universities across the country and was recommended in her case as well. But it was not offered in that job offer. And what we've learned through some great reporting here is that one of the loudest voices against offering her tenure was one of the school's biggest benefactors, the person for whom the school is named.
Yeah, this is a difficult story. I'm in full disclosure, I am a night chair. Mm-hmm. I was part of a letter that the night chairs wrote to the Board of Trustees at the University of North Carolina in support of Nicole Hannah-Jones after they chose not to grant her tenure. Now, the Board of Trustees is saying, oh, we made no decision, but that is disingenuous. The no decision is a decision in this case. And the night chairs are created so that people who are from the profession come in and share their experience with journalism students. And so to say that a professor should have a traditional academic background is also disingenuous. And it appears that the real reason here is that there are some people who are uncomfortable with the work Nicole Hannah-Jones won all these awards for, which is the work she did on the 1619 Project, talking about the history of slavery in the United States. So this is really I hope the University of North Carolina Board of Trustees changes its mind. All of the faculty on the journalism school agree she should get tenure. Usually it's the PhD saying, what are you giving those non-PhDs tenure for? So it's I hope they change their mind.
Okay, well, we will be keeping an eye on that one. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us today. You can read more about everything we talked about on our Links blog. That's on the KBIA website. You can find that at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for our original theme music.